Welcome to the Product Podcast by Product School. Here's a preview of today's talk.
But ultimately, this is not actually about time management and how I see it. It's about influence management. So your influence is kind of like, if you guys ever read The Rainbow Fish as a kid, you think about your influence as like you're a shiny fish and like you can like give away your shiny scales like one by one and everyone gets better and it's great. But you have to choose your time and your projects correctly. So with this, if you do make the time to actually sit with someone and give them feedback on something that's a little out of your realm, like it can be exponentially beneficial for both of you. You are the face of your product. So if you regularly don't meet with someone who keeps asking you for feedback, it's quite likely that they're actually going to feel disconnected from the product. So you do need to meet with people on occasion, even if it's just outside of whether it's a one-on-one or you do want to be like, what are you working on right now? And literally see it. So if you give feedback at the right time on the right project, what it can end up doing is that person feels more confident and more clarity and like they're on the same page and you feel like you have a better understanding of how they're thinking about their work, and you'll end up like strengthening your work relationship and really creating a sort of shorthand with that person so that, you know, if you are really stressed one day and you have to give feedback, like I'm a blunt person, so I do this partially to set up relationships with people so that if I have to send you a one-line Slack message that like someone who doesn't know me might read the wrong way, we already have a shorthand because we have this feedback relationship that's been set up, right?
In this podcast, we teach our listeners valuable lessons about product management and transform them into thinking like a product manager. We teach product management, coding, data analytics, and blockchain in 14 campuses worldwide, including San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. You can find more information at productschool.com. Join our Slack community of 25,000 professionals to network and stay tuned for our upcoming events.
Hey guys, can you guys hear me? So this is pretty lighthearted. It's not necessarily the only five truths in life and product, but I just wanted to talk about some of the wisdom I learned on my unique product journey. So I've only worked at startups, and I worked at first a 400-person startup, then an 80-person startup, now a 10-person startup. Our head of sales likes to introduce me to people as, this is Ariel, she's the product department. We also have like half of, I love my team, they're amazing, but half of our employees at Reserve Pass right now are like under the age of 25. So they're super enthusiastic and they're amazing, but it's just a lot. So like the role that's different, for a product manager who's working at startups, the role is, I think, different than it is at larger corporations. I've never actually worked at a corporation and they're sort of intimidating to me, so I don't know. But I end up playing a role that sort of really spans beyond just getting the product delivered. So I end up being a judge a lot. I end up being a mentor a lot. Sometimes I'm a therapist. And that's just like how it has to go. It's all still in service of the company and in service of the customers and the product. So I kind of wanted to go through a little bit of my journey. Like a lot of people who've been up here today, I was a self-taught PM. So my first product job was an internal promotion. And I taught myself like how to be a product manager by reading a lot of books. And these are all really great books, by the way. So if you want to like, you know, jot them down, I'm sure you've seen a lot of them. Honestly, there's a ton of functional information in them from different areas that are involved in product, like leadership, just general lean practices for startups, testing. Hooked is all about testing. Design of Everyday Things is like canon on design, but really helps sort of hone the way that you look at things and how they're made. So these are all really helpful. And there are actually some things about soft skills for product managers. They tend to be the same things over and over. So I had these sorts of takeaways on the abstract skills that I needed to know. I was told I was going to be the CEO of my product. I was like, cool, that sounds dope. You use influence, not direct power. I was like, okay, I think I'm pretty persuasive. Like I could do that. Saying no is your superpower. No was my first word, so I felt pretty okay on that. Making people feel heard. I did actually get like therapy books to just like figure out how to really nod my head effectively. And like build credibility using data. You know, you got to show up with your slides and all that. And all of this is totally true. And I like soaked it all up. I was like, yes, I'm going to do all these things. I'm going to be this person in the workplace. It's going to be amazing. But the thing about it is, These are true. They're not really skills. They're necessities. So if you don't do them very quickly, you will sink or swim. Like, this is just how to make product happen, especially if you're at a startup. And I didn't have a lot of trouble with the transition into product. I was lucky because I was in an environment that I knew. I'd already worked there for 2 years. I'd worked, as an analyst. And so I really did a lot of competitive work on it. I knew the market better than most of the people at the company, which is how I got the job. I knew my team. I knew the people who were supporting it. Like, I was prepared for success. What I wasn't prepared for was the fact that I just shot up in the organization and all of a sudden people were looking to me for a lot of things. So I actually hit all my big sort of growth road bumps about a year into product. And so I wanted to sort of take this time to go through things that I learned after the fact, like after I was already all these things. So, you're like, oh, hooray, I'm so good, I'm winning at product, right? And then like, no, it's going to continue. It keeps going and you have to keep getting better at it. So this is just five truths that they are like truly general life truths. If you're looking at it, and you're like, yeah, that's true for everything. Like, yeah, I know, that's why I made it. And I want to talk about like how I apply those in specific ways to product and just the workplace and skills that you will brush up against. So the first one is what you do is less important than how you do it. So for product managers, we have a lot of meetings, like a lot of them. And people have a lot of opinions about meetings in general. Like, there's a ton of literature about it. I think like everyone you work with will have like, they have all their theories about meetings, like how they're supposed to be run, how they're not supposed to be run. Meetings are the worst of the devil. Meetings are the best thing ever. If everyone had more meetings, everything would be fine. We just need communication. They're like, you got to send an agenda. You can reject any meeting that doesn't have an agenda or doesn't start within 10 minutes of the set start time. Like, people just get like so into meeting theory. And to me, that's also kind of on the what. Like, you could do everything right. You can be like, we are starting on time. I picked all the right people. I sent out an agenda ahead of time. Everyone is prepared. You can keep time, run your meeting, and you're still going to find yourself occasionally brushed up against what I call the meeting snowball, which is, it happens almost invariably when you are facing something where what you're introducing, like the product that you're working on or the feature that you're working on, involves a lot of dramatic change. Either it's going to be changing a team or it's going to be changing a product. And humans don't love change, like, by nature. And so those meetings can become a little bit contentious. And your job is to make sure that it still gets managed and that it doesn't become a snowball of more meetings at rising intensities closer to the date you're supposed to launch it, because then you're screwed. So the tips that I have for you are, if you are aware ahead of time that the meeting is likely to be contentious, what you can do is meet with everybody individually before the meeting. So everyone you know is going to be in the, every key stakeholder that you're going to be inviting, set up a one-on-one, put the time in. Yeah, it will take you like 7 hours in total. Meet with them all individually and literally run them through the exact same thing you're going to do in the meeting. It makes people feel heard, and you get to understand their concerns at a different in a different environment. So with all meetings, like, if you're going to have, like, let's say you're going to have, 15 stakeholders in the meeting where you're presenting, there's just a different power hierarchy in there. And some people are more introverted than others, and you're going to lose out on people who don't want to share their opinion but might still end up causing conflict down the road because they had concerns that it was your job to manage. So setting it up ahead of time has like two benefits. The person that might have had the concerns has the space to actually feel heard. And even if you end up like rejecting all their concerns, it's like, I hear you, it still has to go forward this way. It's still a different psychological dynamic for them. The other thing is, you end up looking like a superhero when you walk into the meeting because you run through the same thing they've all seen before because you already secretly did the work. And then everyone agrees and it's like a 15-minute meeting and everyone's like, wow, she has so much control. That's amazing. And like, it's great. And you just get to move forward, right? So just put in the work to know ahead of time if something is contentious. Even still, you might not always know ahead of time if something is going to be contentious, and you might find yourself in the middle of the meeting snowball with something you thought was going to be a normal meeting because all of a sudden everybody has all these opinions on the solution that you're presenting and they all have wildly different beliefs. And again, like the tenor is rising because people feel like their idea is more important than everybody else's. And it's natural, I think, as product managers where we're like synthesize solutions, I think the instinct often is to end up trying to draw lines between the solutions that are being presented so that you can find some type of compromise. That won't work in this situation because people are disagreeing so much that they can't actually hear what people are saying. So one tip that I like to use for this is, if you see that like it's rising to a point where you could not possibly catch up and you're stressed because now you're like, I don't even know how to build the thing that they're all coming up with, have everybody stop, take a step back, and write down what they think the problem is. Because when you see how people articulate the problem, you'll see that even if they're basically all saying the same thing, they're going to stress an emphasis on whatever is the thing that matters most to them. And we all need to know that so that we can all build the same solution together. So writing it down just sort of democratizes the process so that like no one bullish person is going to be able to dominate the ideas. And then going through the what the problem actually is helps people sort of take a step back and refocus on the problem, because the solution is not ultimately what matters. The problem is. So tip number two, your influence spans beyond your product. So this one was actually, I think, the hardest for me to learn. If you're very good at product manager, you're like, you know, you're using influence and not direct power, and you're like the CEO of your product, and everybody's like, oh, she's so credible. You're going to find that people want your opinion on so many things, like especially at a startup. I told you, like half of the company I work for is like under 25. So I'm giving a lot of feedback all the time, and it's great. But there's a balancing act involved here. People might ask you anything from, can you proofread this marketing email that supports the launch that, you know, as of your product, to what do you think we should do at the holiday party? And you kind of have to pick and choose. Because it is a balancing act, the only wrong ways to do this are to go from one side to the other. So either saying, no, I only focus on things that are directly within my responsibilities as a product manager, everything else is a waste of my time, I'm a ruthless prioritizer, or the opposite, which is just being like, I don't know, I seem so important, and just like racking up this constant list of, like this constant giant growing list of requests for feedback, because you don't have time for that, right? But ultimately, this is not actually about time management and how I see it. It's about influence management. So your influence is kind of like, if you guys ever read The Rainbow Fish as a kid, you think about your influence as like you're a shiny fish, and like you can like give away your shiny scales like one by one, and everyone gets better and it's great. But you have to choose your time and your projects correctly. So with this, if you do make the time to actually sit with someone and give them feedback on something that's a little out of your realm, like it can be exponentially beneficial for both of you. You are the face of your product, so if you regularly don't meet with someone who keeps asking you for feedback, it's quite likely that they're actually going to feel disconnected from the product. So you do need to meet with people on occasion, even if it's just outside of whether it's a one-on-one, or you do want to be like, what are you working on right now, and literally see it. But yeah, so if you give feedback at the right time on the right project, what it can end up doing is that person feels more confident and more clarity, and like they're on the same page, and you feel like you have a better understanding of how they're thinking about their work, and you'll end up like strengthening your work relationship and really creating a sort of shorthand with that person so that, you know, if you are really stressed one day and you have to give feedback, like I'm a blunt person, so I do this partially to set up relationships with people so that if I have to send you a one-line Slack message that like someone who doesn't know me might read the wrong way, we already have a shorthand because we have this feedback relationship that's been set up, right? There are times to not give feedback and to not use your influence. And this one I think is a little harder to suss out. So I would say the obvious ones to me are if you don't understand the soft context of something, so you don't understand the team dynamics. So like if it's someone from a different team and they just have a new org leader and then they're asking you for feedback, I would just be a little wary of that and be like, you don't want it to end up being that you gave feedback and then when they're in their marketing meeting, they're like, well, Ariel said, like you don't want to end up there. Or the other wrong time is if somebody is repeatedly asking you for feedback, even if it's like your own direct report, which is a different level of this sort of truth, you have to be able to establish some sort of trust in themselves where you can't keep giving feedback because they'll think that they need it every time. And so no is not the only superpower as a product manager. Like sometimes the most powerful thing you can say is like, I trust you, you got this, right? And just let people do their work means less work for you and they'll become more confident in what they're doing. A healthy ego is big enough for everyone in the room. So I meet a lot of aspiring PMs, and I met this guy last year, and I was like, I always ask them like, oh, why do you want to go into product? Like, what inspired you? And he was like, just point blank. He said, oh, I want a more powerful job. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I appreciate your candor, but you might want to get a different answer for the interview circuit. Like, all right. So yeah, a lot of product managers have an ego. A lot of great leaders have an ego. If you're familiar with the DISC personality test, a lot of product managers are in the D quadrant. Some people say that stands for dominant. I like to think it stands for driving. But yeah, so you have to be pretty confident to be able to do this job because it does require a lot and it requires sort of trusting yourself. Where I think this shows up a lot for PMs, or like it shows up all the time really, but one example is like when you think about a big ego versus a healthy ego, a big ego needs to take up space. And the way that they do that is they push on all the edges so that they get more space. A healthy ego essentially ends up creating more space by like carrying a happy backpack with the whole team in it on their very confident backs. Like that's what they do, right? And there's a lot of things you're going to have to let slide just for no other reason than to let things move forward. But a lot of leadership materials, a lot of people who are great leaders, like one of the truisms, a truism adjacent to this truism is that great leaders like don't take any of the credit and they take all the blame, right? And so you're kind of going to be in that position, which is why when the guy was like, oh, I want more power, I was like, ooh, it doesn't work like that. So there's not really a lot that you're singularly responsible for as a product manager. So there aren't really that many instances where you could be like, that was me. That was all me. I literally did that for everybody. You're welcome. Because the pre-development process involves a lot of people. You have to like synthesize all the ideas from the stakeholders, the partners, the customers, the data. Like you're relying on essentially a lot of, like at best, the smartest thing you can be is just someone who can synthesize that information really well. But someone's like, you got to get it from someone. It's got to come from somewhere. So you don't really, you have the requirements, but you're just really like pulling in all the other ideas. And then the development, like the stuff you actually launch, like you're responsible for it, but you didn't build it. Like you didn't do that. You know, engineering built it, QA tested it, marketing supported it. You're just like, oh yeah, well, that was me. So I think we like get that credit isn't something that totally applies to product managers. Like if you're just a great product manager, like that's your credit. Blame is a little different. So because you, hypothetically, if you're not responsible for any one thing, you're technically not blamed for any one thing either. But it is true that like one of the best things a product manager can do is be really comfortable taking blame for things that were like totally not their fault. And because you're in a position where you end up seeing intimately how every team does work towards like, let's say it's a huge feature launch or like you're launching an entirely new product, right? If you really saw how all of those teams I just mentioned contributed to that, you actually are probably like the only person who does technically know where the ball got dropped. And, you know, you have to work on that. So you have to be able to figure out how to solve that problem in the future, obviously. But let's say that you're even in a very, very healthy workplace environment where no one's particularly interested in placing blame. Everybody knows we just want to move forward. You're still going to find yourself in conversations where people who are not on the team that hypothetically dropped the ball are talking about how the ball got dropped. So like if you're in like a meeting with executive stakeholders and they're like, oh yeah, why is this like, you know, it's a month late and it's like, oh, someone's filling another person in. And they're like, yeah, there were like 3 bugs for every single story engineering did. It was like really crap code, honestly. Or let's say that you're in retro and engineering is frustrated because they shipped a month late because the stakeholders just like continued to change the designs and could not make up their mind. And it was like running on a treadmill of stories and they just could not develop effectively. Your choices are like, you could just sit and let that happen. If you're in a workplace that is going to, you already know that you're working on solving the problem with the teams and like, it's all going to go away. And you could just be like, whatever, people are venting. Or you could literally just scoop it up and be like, if you're in the executive meeting, for instance, be like, oh, sorry, that was totally my fault. I didn't put enough time in the plan for architectural planning. So that's why there were so many bugs. Or if it's an engineering retro and they're like, oh, the stakeholders got like totally out of control. You could be like, I'm sorry, that was my fault. I didn't put enough time into consensus building. Like I totally should have spent more time really making sure we were all on the same page. Hypothetically, like neither of those things were actually your fault at all, but it's like a Jedi mind trick where if you just scoop it up and put it in your ego backpack because you're so healthy and confident, people are like, oh, okay, well, she's got it under control. And it does this weird thing where you actually seem like you have more control because you're willing to be like, no, it's totally under control. I got it, right? So that's where the healthy ego plays in. Truth number 4, this is not your last great idea. So all the books that were at the beginning, I'm sure they all have said this stuff and like the, you know, all the great product school classes, like you'll learn early that you can't get super in love with your darlings because some of them are going to die. It could be you have a really great idea that you love and it gets to testing and you spend all this time on it and it just doesn't work and you got to let it go. Or it could be even before development where you really, really want to do something one way and you're like quite sure it's correct, but you just cannot seem to get consensus around it. So you just like take the higher road and are like, whatever, the data is going to show whether it was right or not wrong anyway. So you kind of like let that one go for a little bit and just like let it slide, right? those are all examples of it's not your last great idea, and some ideas get thrown away. But I'm actually talking here about the way that you manage idea generation on your team and like in your organization. So because, again, product managers are synthesizers, it behooves you and the entire environment of your workplace to have a sort of free-for-all, like all ideas are welcome, like, you know, really making sure people feel comfortable just putting in feature requests, or even something as like, hey, should we go into this totally weird business that doesn't seem obvious at all? Like, people should definitely feel confident having that space to do that. And there's a lot of different platforms to be able to do that. So at Resort Pass, how we do it is we have a Trello board that's like our pre-backlog board. It's like a bullpen for pre-JIRA tickets. So I don't want anything in JIRA unless it's been totally fleshed out and has all the requirements and could be scooped up for development at any given time. But there needs to be a place to sort of put, you know, like digital post-it notes of good ideas that get discussed. And so for us, that's our Trello board. And I go through the board once a week with our executive team, since they're the primary contributors to all the ideas. And I was going through it a couple weeks ago, and I was sitting with the CEO, and we went through like a ticket she'd suggested of a banner she wanted to add, and we kind of discussed it, and I gave my opinion on it, and then we talked about, like, you know, is it worth building? And we realized that a future product that we're going to be doing might end up solving that problem itself. And so I said, okay, cool, so can we just delete it? And she goes, no, don't delete it. Where will it go? And I was like, if it's a good idea, like, it's going to come back to us. Like, we don't need to have a place to store ideas we've already decided that we don't need. Like, it's not that the idea was bad. We just don't need it here. So the human brain can hold on to like about seven items in its short-term memory. And in addition to making sure that your team has a really ruthless funnel set up for the ideas. So for instance, the one I just talked about was only the best, most important, most developed ideas actually get into sprints. The level above that is JIRA, where the entire backlog in JIRA is super organized and ready for development. And they're all things we've chosen that we want, even though we probably won't build a lot of them. And then the idea up, the list up from that is the Trello board, which is essentially a free-for-all, except that it's not, because I also call that all the time. Because I want people to be able to see all the ideas that are new and that are going to get triaged in one screen, like one viewport should be able to see it. If we have 1,000 ideas on there, like, none of the ideas are important, even the best one that's hiding at like number 755 that wasn't triaged. So the most important thing for that is that if you are an inbox zero person or your team is inbox zero people, they're probably a little bit more comfortable with the idea of just like getting rid of an idea and like ruthlessly being like, I don't need it. I don't need to prioritize that, right? Some people are not. So it is important that when you do this process, like whatever tools you use, that you do it with the stakeholder, either in person as like a regular triage meeting, which is how I like to do it. But you have to make sure that the people who are like contributing the ideas are the ones who actually feel like they understand why their idea is being rejected, so that it doesn't feel like their idea is being rejected. You're just like, we aren't going to prioritize that. So the last truth is credibility isn't built on data alone. So imagine that you're boarding a plane and the pilot, like, everyone's like tucked in, got their seatbelts, and you're like so ready, right? And the pilot comes on, he goes, hi, I'm Dave, I'll be your pilot. We're on this brand new 747, it's beautiful. It's a sunny day in Los Angeles. Our flight's gonna be about an hour and 48 minutes. It's mostly sunny, but there is a little bit of thunderstorms over the mountains, so you might see some turbulence there. When we get to our cruising altitude of 37,000 feet, you will be able to take off your seatbelts and feel free to roam around the cabin. I actually don't know what any of these blips and bleeps mean, but I'm a data-driven pilot, so this plane is like running on technology because it's the future, right? You're probably not going to be on that plane, are you? Like, that doesn't sound super confidence. So the thing about it is, like, planes are a good example of, actually, a lot of them are sort of mostly running on autopilot. They mostly are running on technology. Like, there's only so many things a pilot does need to do on a normal flight. But you don't need the pilot there for a normal flight. You need the pilot there for an abnormal flight. So credibility is not something, like, we talk a lot about data-driven product development, and I think it really does get warped sometime. We're like, a product manager is not the keeper of data. You're the keeper of a vision. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. So if you don't, like, one, if you don't know how to ask the right questions, your data is totally useless. I can lie with data, like, so easily. Like, I can make stuff up using real numbers and trick most people, right? Like, it's not, like, data is not the solution, right? So it's just supporting evidence for you to be able to build a credible case and for you to consistently share that confidence, like share this influence of like everything is under control. We have a path forward. We're moving in the positive direction. And to do that, you have to like have the right data, use it the right way, focus it in the right directions. But you have to also like convey that to each team member in a way that they care about, right? Certain supporting teams are only going to care about certain data points. You should only care about certain data points. Like some of them are more important than others. And you can't just build it by constantly having like the right answer. You have to actually build it by, you know, building relationships with the people on your team so that they feel like they understand the vision and the solutions that you're going to work towards to all the problems that you have in the same way that you understand it. So that is my, that's my thing. those are all my wisdoms. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to know more about our courses and next courts, visit productschool.com. Stay tuned for the next episode to learn more about the secrets in product management.